Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the Rockies to the Pacific Coast, people have built a great life on the rugged, arid lands of the American West. Cities are growing. California is the agricultural powerhouse for the nation. All of that depends on water, but the West is in the midst of a water crisis with low reservoirs and now shocking new data on a massive drop in groundwater supplies. Many water experts say the day of reckoning is near. This hour on Point, a Western conversation about water. You can join us on air and online. Californians, Arizonans, Coloradans, New Mexicans, does this drought feel any different? Is your community asking you to change the way you use or misuse water? And what kind of permanent change in our way of life will we need to deal with the long-term water crisis? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us first today from Pasadena, California, is Jay Famiglietti. He is professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He and his colleagues at NASA just released a new study of water loss in the Colorado River Basin, a key source of water for much of the western United States. Jay Famiglietti, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, I want to really zero in with you on your findings about groundwater loss. But before we do that, I was just looking at an op-ed that you recently wrote in the LA Times. And you described the current drought that much of the West is in as basically the worst drought since record keeping began in the late 1800s. That's not going to be news to a lot of people in the West. But then you go on to write that without a few successive winters of above average precipitation, we only have enough water in storage to get through the next 12 to 18 months, and that's it. And I suppose you're specifically writing about Southern California. So is the water crisis, First of all, that bad?
It is that bad. First, to clarify, when I'm talking about the 12 to 18 months, really we're talking about surface water storage, so the water that's available in reservoirs. And so that is it. That's how much water we have. And after that, then we hit the groundwater. There is groundwater available, but we're depleting it very, very rapidly. So that's really the point of the op-ed, and hopefully an outcome of these papers that we've been writing. It really highlights that we need to be very, very careful with our groundwater resource because it is the strategic backup during drought.
Right. So people living in the West and in the drought-stricken parts of the country see every day with their own eyes what the effect of the loss of surface water is. But what you found regarding groundwater losses is pretty shocking. So first of all, let's define what area we're talking about. The Colorado Basin, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, California, home to 40 million people, 4 million acres of very important farmland. How much water has been lost there in the past 9 years, and how much is it groundwater loss?
So you're right, Meghna. It's a huge swath of the Western United States is the workhorse, the water workhorse of the Western U.S. We found that over the last 9 or so years, so we were specifically looking in this period during which, after which the reservoirs had fallen to low level, because we wanted to isolate how much, try to really understand how much groundwater was being used. And so what we found is that since the beginning of 2005 or late 2004, that the region has lost 65 cubic kilometers of fresh water. That's two times the volumes of Lake Mead, so two Lake Meads. And that 75% of that is groundwater, the water that's stored underground in our soils and in our aquifers.
So 75% of the overall water loss is coming from groundwater loss. I mean, that's enormous amount. Now, when you found that out, I mean, did it shock you? Because it's the vast majority of the water loss.
That's right. It was shocking. We were quite surprised. We know water managers know, and people who pay attention to water issues understand that during drought, we have to use groundwater because we have no other choice, and that's how water is managed all over the world. But I don't think anyone, in fact, I know that no one's really taken a look at what's been happening basin-wide. And so to, you know, to find out that most of the water that was being lost was from groundwater was really a huge surprise.
Well, I wonder if we could sort of put these in terms that maybe non-water experts might understand better. When we're talking about, what, 41 million acre-feet of water, of groundwater being lost in the past 9 years, how much is that? Like, how much of the United States of annual water use could that have covered?
Well, we're talking about annual water use for tens of millions of families. It's just an almost unbelievable amount of water. It was a real eye-opener, and hopefully not only will the public pay attention to these results, but also our water managers and our elected officials and environmental decision makers.
Right. And so, I mean, this has been going on. You looked at a 9-year period to do these measurements. And obviously, there's been at least a 14-year drought in much of Western United States. So, I mean, what's leading to a lot of farmers and cities, et cetera, to go directly into the ground and tap their groundwater? Is it just that they're not being allocated sufficient amounts of surface water?
Well, that's part of it, or that it's just not available because of the drought, or both. It really depends on the state and the time period that we're talking about. But you know, the bottom line is it's been an extended drought in the western United States, and California behaves very similarly to the Colorado River Basin. So when we look at California in our data, and so we look at when we look at California, or we look at the Colorado River Basin, they behave the same way, And so the bottom line is that if there's no precipitation, if there's no snow, if there's no snowpack and snow melt, or if that snowpack is decreasing, then there's nothing to feed the rivers and there's nothing to feed the reservoirs. So our managers do have to cut back on the allocations to make sure that everyone gets some water. And we have no choice but to hit the groundwater. And it's just unfortunate that we have to hit it so hard because the drought is as bad as it is. And it really points to the need for some regulation.
Mm, okay, so we're going to talk about the types of regulation that people could consider in a little bit. But I want to just talk a little bit more about the specifics of groundwater itself, because we don't see it until we tap it, right? And so I've been doing quite a bit of reading about this. And what I understand from your paper and others is that in a way, what we're seeing is basically the effects of also a century-long decline in the amount of groundwater in the Colorado River Basin. Is that accurate to say?
I think that it is accurate. I think that with much of the groundwater we have in the western United States, much of it is non-renewable. So it accumulated. It was it filled up the aquifers over decades, centuries, millennia, and more. And we're pulling it out at a much faster rate than it was originally emplaced in the aquifers. So we are mining our groundwater, and it's in a long-term steady decline. Mm. And we really have to be aware of that, because we will begin to run out. And if we don't run out, one of the things that's already happening is as you go deeper into an aquifer, as you tap the lower and lower levels of water, the quality decreases. The energy cost to pump the water out increases because the water is at a deeper level. So there's a higher lift. We have more subsidence of the ground at the surface. So there's all kinds of problems. And, you know, collectively, it points to some huge issues ahead for us in the western United States.
Well, explain to me why some of them are non-renewable or non-rechargeable underground aquifers. I mean, I take your point that it took decades, even millennia, for some of them to fill up. But say, and I don't think we're seeing this in the near future, but say we had 5 or 10 really wet years in the West coming up. Why is that inadequate to really recharge the groundwater supply?
Because we're using much more than we have available. So of course, you know, the wet years are going to replenish our groundwater, and some of it, you know, a lot of it is renewable. So a lot of it, water levels move up and down depending on the aquifers, and so there's plenty of places where that happens. But But when you look over the whole basin, and in particular in the southern basin, which is Arizona and Nevada for the most part, we are way past that point of renewable water resources. We've gone way, way deep, and you know, that's our history. We need to admit to ourselves that that's what we've been doing. That we're just using more than that's being replenished naturally.
All right. So many states have declared some form of water crisis given this drought, but given the loss of groundwater that we've been talking about, can you just tell me briefly what you think the impact of not being able to replenish that groundwater will be on the way of life for people in the Colorado River Basin in the, you know, near or long-term future?
I think it's going to have a huge impact on the way of life in the western U.S. One of the messages of the study that we did is that we're relying on groundwater way more than we thought we were. And so we make a point that over the last 10 years or so, that the basin's been over-allocated by 30%. Or in other words, you know, we're using 30% more than, we talk about allocations of 15 million acre feet for the basin. We're using 30% more than that, and that's coming from groundwater. So if we run out of that, we will not be able to, the Colorado River Basin, right, the western U.S., will not be able to meet the allocations to the different basin states, to right. California, to Arizona, to Nevada.
So demand will continue to outstrip supply, which of course has some very obvious outcomes.
Absolutely.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're looking at water in the American West and the future of a Western way of life that has long been highly dependent on water. And we're looking specifically at shocking new findings regarding groundwater losses in the Colorado River Basin. That's home to 40 million people and 4 million acres of farmland. So does this new groundwater study from NASA have you spooked, or do you think that water management and water resources can be figured out in a way that helps us survive this current 14-year drought that the Western United States is in? What should we do to conserve, preserve, and even possibly generate new water supplies to keep a growing part of the nation growing? My guest this hour is Jay Famlietti. He's senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and co-author of a new study on underground water supplies in the Colorado Basin. That is the study that found that 75% of the overall water loss in the basin in the past 9 years is in the form of groundwater supply loss. Now, to get a sense as to what the drought has had or what kind of impact it's had on life in the West, let's listen to a couple people who know about that well. Last Tuesday, the Pasadena City Council declared a local water emergency and strengthened wastewater restrictions. Wendy De Leon of the city's Department of Water and Power spoke to CBS Los Angeles about the importance of conservation.
It's a very serious situation. We want to ensure that we have water supply not only for today, but for our children in the future. And this will just get us in line with making sure the public is aware that this is a serious situation. It's been declared a drought officially from the governor since January, and we want to ensure we take all the steps that we need to support our community to start conserving even more water.
Wendy De Leon of the Pasadena City Council Department of Water and Power, referring there, by the way, to the call from California Governor Jerry Brown for the state to cut its water use by 20%. They've had variable success there. 58% of California is currently under exceptional drought conditions. Now, of course, California's Central Valley, a hugely important agricultural center for the entire United States, they've already lost $2.2 billion in crops and jobs due to this drought. In early July, Bill Dietrich, a farmer from Fresno, California, talked to the New York Times about the impact the drought has had on farmers.
A grower like myself, fourth generation, who has so much emotion and so much of his passion tied up in dirt and production and making things grow, this is a heartbreaker.
That's farmer Bill Diederich from Fresno, California. Now, Jay Familietti from Pasadena. Let me ask you this quick question, because we got an interesting message on OnPoint's Facebook page from Cher Lastin, who writes, "There is exactly the same percentage of water on the planet today as there was billions of years ago. It appears that it can be redistributed. I have an artesian aquifer that dries up once every 10 to 15 years, but it does return." So Cher says management is critical for access. And yes, humans can have an adverse effect on our natural resources, but enough with these dramatic headlines and scare tactics. Does Cher Lastin have a point?
No, I don't think that she does. Let me retract that, immediately retract that statement. So the amount of water on the planet is fixed. But it is being redistributed, and that's the problem. And so what we're seeing is that the dry areas of the world are getting drier, and those are the places where we spend groundwater quite heavily. So that's the situation that we face. She may have access to a sound water supply, but most of California and a lot of the western United States does not, and a lot of the arid and semi-arid parts of the world are in the same boat.
Mm. Well, Jay, stand by for just a second, because I want to bring a couple other voices into this conversation. Mike Wade is joining us from Sacramento, California. He's executive director of California Farm Water Coalition. Mike Wade, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also joining us is Sandra Postel. She's an expert on global water issues and policy, and she's the Freshwater Fellow of the National Geographic Society and Director of the Global Water Policy Project and author of Last Oasis, Facing Water Scarcity. She joins us today from Los Lunas, New Mexico. Sandra Postel, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's great to have you. Mike, let me just start with you. You're the executive director of California's Farm Water Coalition, so obviously agriculture at the center of what you're thinking about and concerned about. I'm seeing numbers that ag in California or the West in general uses 75-80% of the overall water that's used there. So what's your primary concern about how this drought has been going and these groundwater findings that Jay was talking to us about?
Well, water distribution in California is divided among three primary users. It's actually agriculture, urban users, and amounts of water that we've dedicated for environmental purposes. And of that, agriculture uses about 41%. And it is important, not just for farmers in California, of course, but for much of the nation, because California does provide half of the U.S. supply of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Mm. And so, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, California, for example, has already seen a $2.2 billion negative impact due to this drought. I mean, are there certain aspects or certain actions that farmers can take immediately to mitigate that impact or even further lessen their water use overall?
Farmers have been fallowing a tremendous amount of farmland, as much as 400 to 500,000 acres this year that formerly was used to grow food for our citizens and for much of the country. So water conservation, while it's important, and farmers have done a tremendous job investing almost $3 billion over the last 10 years in improving the efficiency of irrigation systems, we are seeing the next step, and that's taking land out of production simply because the drought and regulatory issues have limited the amount of water we deliver to our farms today.
I guess maybe I should just ask this in a more upfront way, and that is when some people hear that agriculture uses the vast majority or a huge majority of the overall water that's used in the West, they point to agriculture itself. Like maybe farmers need to be stretching themselves and doing even more, whatever they can, whether it's, you know, enabling more pinpointing accuracy on where to water and how or the types of crops or further fallowing fields, as you're saying, that they could have the most immediate and largest impact in terms of overall water use in, you know, the drought-stricken West.
Farmers are willing adopters of new technology. And we've seen that over the decades as new irrigation and new land management techniques come into play. When they're affordable and when they're available, California farmers especially put them into practice. But we're seeing extreme situations this year with the drought and with impacts on agriculture that are affecting food production, but it affects consumers because they're really the end users of water that goes on the farm.
Right. I mean, so we're seeing food prices go up in part because it's costing more to just to raise the food in places like the Central Valley of California. Mike, stand by for a second. Sandra Postel, you're an expert on global water issues and policy. And, you know, one thing that I come away with in reading about all of this and talking to friends and family who live out west is that there is no one solution. And part of the problem is that there's a huge, complicated thicket of policy, regulations, areas of who controls what when it comes to water in the West. I mean, how do we tease that apart?
Well, it is complicated. And, you know, in some sense, here we are with 21st century problems, including the climate wild card now, which, you know, virtually all the climate models say that the Southwest and much of the West in general is going to be in for hotter and drier times. And so this drought, you know, is, I think, a preview of things to come and suggests we really do need to look at the rules and signals and other incentives and disincentives to how we're using water. And so, you know, in some sense, we're trying to solve these problems with 19th century laws and policies. So in a lot of ways, we need to update. And, you know, for sure, this drought has been a heartbreaker for many farmers in particular in the West.
Right.
And so farmers are very good business people. They're going to respond to the signals that society presents to them about water use, what crops they grow, how much water they put on it. They're going to use those inputs as efficiently as possible, soil, water, sun, and labor, and use those things to maximize their profits as any good business person would.
Well, I'm curious about how – I'm sorry to interrupt there, but I am curious about how hobbled we are in terms of finding long-term solutions based on these arcane, sometimes decades or even more than a century old water laws. Like, for example, in southern Texas, I see that the state has cut off deliveries of river water to some rice farmers there for 3 years in a row because they need to sustain reservoirs that supply the city of Austin. And the farmers there have no water rights because they sold them to the Lower Colorado River Authority decades ago. So they can't grow their rice, but they're complaining that they're still seeing people in the city of Austin washing their cars and watering their golf courses.
Right. There needs to be, you know, incentives across the board. You know, we have agriculture, industries, and cities all, in some sense, competing for water and, of course, the environment. I mean, don't forget, we have a $26 billion economy in the Colorado River Basin that depends on healthy rivers. All the businesses that depend on you know, fly fishing and tubing and all the other things that a healthy river provides. And so the environment needs to be factored into this allocation. And I think the silver lining is that we do have a lot we can do to bring policies up to date, to give the right signals and incentives for more efficient water use. Mike's correct that a lot has been done to improve agricultural efficiency, but particularly throughout the Colorado River Basin, much more could be done. Mm. We've just scratched the surface in terms of what conservation and efficiency can accomplish, and it's much cheaper. Conservation and efficiency continues to be much cheaper than building new dams or desalination plants and that kind of thing. And that's really the silver lining in this. Also, groundwater recharge. We haven't talked about that. We're talking about groundwater depletion, but we can also actively try to recharge those supplies. And that, too, is a supply option that's cheaper by and large, often a third as much as desalination or building a new reservoir.
But we heard Jay Famiglietti tell us a little bit earlier in the program that some of these groundwater aquifers may never get recharged, or their recharge rate is so slow that we can't rely on that.
Right. Some aquifers are effectively non-renewable. It's like oil. Once you pump the water out, it's effectively gone and will not get recharged from rain and snow that falls today. But you can actively recharge through in a rechargeable aquifer, you know, through a big pond where you let the water infiltrate down, or through injection wells. That's a bit more of an energy-intensive process to take storm water and other water that might otherwise not be productive for us and use it to recharge groundwater. Arizona's been doing a lot of groundwater recharge and Southern California also. So doing more active management of surface water and groundwater together. This is part of the problem, and we see Lake Mead going down, down, down. We haven't seen, until Jay's study came out, what's really happening underground.
Yeah.
And it tells us we have one water. We need to manage groundwater and surface water as one.
Sandra Postel, stand by for just a second, because we've got a ton of callers who want to join us. So let's start in Wenham, Massachusetts. John is calling. You're on the air, John.
All right. Hi, Meghna. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm a student. I studied in Pasadena, California for some time. And something that I learned about is, basically the origination of our city, Los Angeles, when we were siting our city, it was not really an ideal location for water. And the founder, original founder, found that there is a ideal source in the Owens Valley or River. Because of this abundant source, there is a false image portrayed much through Hollywood of palm trees and green lawns and just sort of an illusion that was broadcast.
Palm trees in the desert, exactly.
Los Angeles.
Well, John, let me ask you, what's your thought on how we could conserve more water today? I mean, you heard Sandra Postel give quite a list of possibilities. I mean, you've lived in Pasadena a while back. You know, what do you think is most realistic to enact right now?
Yeah, it is that because of this false image and sort of illusion, people have been propagating this idea by watering their lawns, building more golf courses, not only that, but the city of Los Angeles has grown into other cities and other cities. And
so maybe breaking old habits and not having lawns and golf courses, et cetera. So more conservation. John, thank you so much for your call. Jay Famiglietti, let me just turn back to you on that. I think I'm hearing a couple lines of attack here in terms of solving the long-term water crisis here. Is conservation, let's focus on residential conservation, enough, or do we need to do even more aggressively at a larger level?
So conservation and efficiency are really our first the first steps that we should be taking. And Sandra is absolutely correct. I mean, there's so much so many gains that can be realized. We can do a lot more with a lot less. There's no one silver bullet. And our caller John raises an important issue, and that is, we have built a bit of a house of cards, and sustaining the house of cards will be very, very challenging. So we have to start with conservation and efficiency, doing a lot more with a lot less, and then thinking about bigger infrastructure projects after that.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the long-term water crisis in the Western United States today. My guests today are Jay Famiglietti. He is a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and co-authored a new study on the water losses in the Colorado River Water Basin. He joins us from Pasadena, California. Mike Wade is with us from Sacramento. He's executive director of the California Farm Water Coalition. And Sandra Postel joins us from Las Lunas, New Mexico. She's an expert on global water issues and policy and author of Last Oasis, Facing Water Scarcity. Now, obviously, a lot of states are in high gear when it comes to trying to get the word out on water conservation. Here's a recent water conservation PSA starring Lady Gaga, released by the Save Our Water campaign, which is a partnership between the Association of California Water Agencies and the California Department of Water Resources.
I had the honor of shooting my music video at California landmark Hearst Castle. And while I was there, I learned about the necessity of water conservation during this drought. Do your part to help save water at home. Go to saveourh2o.org.
So Lady Gaga there learning about the necessity of water conservation. I think all California residents know that pretty well, since recently the state opted to enact an up to $500 a day fine if residents are found wasting water. Now, that's up to local water resources management boards to institute that fine, but it's an option now in the state of California. Jay Famiglietti, let me just turn to you really quickly, because I think part of the problem here is, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when it comes to groundwater, since we're talking about how much groundwater has been lost and the long-term implications of that, states actually regulate groundwater use on their own. I'm seeing California has no groundwater management rules, whereas Arizona, as Sandra Postel was telling us earlier, has really been rather aggressive in transferring surface water into underground aquifers. So that can't be helping that you have different regulations from state to state in the basin.
No, that's right. And like we do have interstate discussion and a framework for managing the surface waters, we don't really have that for groundwater. And that's a problem, because the groundwater resources do span the aquifers, span the political boundaries, the state boundaries. They don't know those boundaries. And so that really points to the need for to bring groundwater management into basin-wide discussion.
Mm. So Mike Wade, you're with the California Farm Water Coalition. I mean, basin-wide regulation means some sort of oversight, whether it's, you know, by regional groups or possibly the federal government. Would the agriculture industry, would farmers welcome that?
Two legislative bills are working their way through Sacramento, and there is tremendous support and involvement in the agriculture community. And they authorize and direct local agencies to initiate new groundwater management activities. And so that's coming, and there is a lot of agriculture involvement in that, and I think that's going to be an important tool to help us get a handle on the groundwater situation. I do want to say the work that Dr. Famiglietti is doing is vital, and it is providing an important new tool that we can use to see our water supply situation and help us better manage not only agricultural water and urban water, but get our arms around the amount of water, a full 50% that we dedicate to environmental purposes. And while agricultural and urban water users are required to do water management plans, we don't do that with our environmental resources. And I think that shortchanges the public that invests in our environmental resources, and we don't know whether we're accomplishing the goals that we have before us to make sure we have a clean and healthy environment. We don't know if the water we've dedicated to that is providing the benefits to endangered species that we hope to achieve.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, I'm seeing here that, for example, there may be tools in our regulatory toolkit that don't even require further oversight. For example, I'm seeing that farmers aren't necessarily incentivized to conserve even more because they can't sell or lease water or water rights to other cities or other groups. And Michael Johnson on OnPoint's Facebook page says, let the markets determine the price of water for individuals and corporations alike. I mean, would that work for the agriculture industry, Mike Wade?
Well, that it will work, and it is working this year. We're seeing water costs approaching $2,000 an acre foot in the agriculture community, and farmers that have high value crops are working to rescue and to save those crops through the year because of the drought, and they're paying top dollar for water to just keep orchards and vineyards and the high value crops alive. So we are seeing a more resilient water market this year. It's dynamic, and it is certainly being affected by the drought.
Mm. Let's take a call. David is calling from Bettendorf, Iowa. You're on the air, David.
Hi. I just had a couple of points. One, this was predicted in the 90s. There was an excellent book I'd like to encourage everyone to read, Cadillac Desert, talked about this very thing happening in the West. And then the other point is, I'm not a Tea Partier, but I live in Iowa. I've lived in the West. Why should I pay some national program, as an example, to, in my words, bail out the West, just because someone wants to live in a climate that's, say, nicer than Iowa? And that uncontrolled growth has to stop. It just can't keep going on. And I, for my part, would say, let's pay the true cost of the water in the West. And if for me not to have strawberries in the winter from the Central Valley, that might be okay.
David, let me take it from you there, because you make a very interesting point that sort of takes this conversation into what's the impact possibly on the rest of the United States when we talk about solutions to the Western water crisis. Thank you so much for your call. Sandra Postel, I mean, respond to what David says. There is a huge political hill to climb here if we're talking about regulation of any kind, or even possibly, and this is what David's saying, what if we had to subsidize the Western way of life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the response is sort of this three-legged stool. People respond to pricing, to markets, and to regulation. And I think we can make advances in all three of those. You know, he's absolutely right that you know, a lot of the, you know, the water costs and the water use is really deriving from the government's decision back in the early 1900s to encourage people and farmers and others to move to the West. And that was sort of the early 20th century. Well, we're a century more and more beyond that now, and we haven't really updated those incentives. So getting prices more right, getting markets right. Just last week, the water utilities that serve Denver, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles, along with the Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that handles irrigation in the West, they joined together and set up an $11 million conservation program fund designed to see, can we basically collaborate and cooperate and find areas where we can voluntarily move water from one use to another and encourage efficiency in this way and try to keep the levels of Lake Mead and hopefully groundwater levels up. It's a pilot project. It's a drop in the bucket. $11 million is not a lot of money, but the idea is to see, can we do this? Can we work together to try to open up markets, open up being able to move water from one use to another, incentivize efficiency? These are the kinds of things that we need. We've seen with our Change the Course program that if you provide those opportunities, you can have, you know, healthy rivers along with healthy agriculture. And I just want to respond to something Mike said, which is in the Colorado River Basin, we have a lot of depleted ecosystems because water hasn't been purposely allocated to the environment. From headwaters all the way down to the delta, we're working to try to get flows back in because those allocations haven't been made to the environment. And degraded ecosystems are bad for the economy, and they're bad, of course, for the web of life and all that we depend on. So those things need to be factored in as well.
Right.
But I think there's, again, the silver lining is there's so much we can do now to make that happen.
I suppose the question is whether or not there's the political will to do it. There's a lot of activity on OnPoint's Facebook page on this. Lita Tilton says, duh, Vegas. No swimming pools, spas, golf courses, car washes, street washing, and restrict each household to a given amount each day. If they go over, cut them off or triple the price. Some harsh lessons there from Lita Tilton. Matt Pines echoes that and says abandoning Vegas would be a good start. But Marla Stultz says, or rebuts, it's not just Las Vegas that has impacted the underground aquifers and reservoirs. All of the Southwest region has a role to play. Now, Jay Famiglietti, you, in your LA Times op-ed from not that long ago, actually called for mandatory water restrictions with enforcement and fines for violations. What did you mean by that?
Well, so that was inspired by watching my neighbor. So I live in Sierra Madre now, just east of Pasadena. It's a small mountain town. It's very, very hot. It's extremely dry. Water levels are ridiculously low in the four wells that the town operates. And so that op-ed was inspired by conversations with my wife, actually, first and foremost, but then also watching a neighbor wash leaves down the gutter in his driveway with a high pressure nozzle. So things are getting ridiculous, and it was really a response also to the fact that, you know, the governor asked for voluntary 20% reductions in water use, and the LA Times published a story that said that hadn't happened, that reductions were more like 5%, and some of the big cities had actually increased. So you know, my message was, if we need to be forced to do this, so be it, because we're not responding the way that we should be.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've been talking quite a bit earlier in the program with Mike about agriculture's current use of water, you know, 75% to 80% of the overall water use in the West. But I'm seeing that the Texas Water Development Board, which is the state's planning agency there, says that urban water demand, at least in Texas, is going to rise by 75% by the year 2060, while use for irrigation will decline by 17%. So cities, not farmers, will be the dominant consumers of water. Is that where we should be focusing our conservation efforts right now then, Jay?
Well, so cities are playing a huge role, and there's a lot of movement to cities. So it's very important that we focus on that. But I still say that when we look over broader regions, we need to be the biggest number out there for water use is agriculture. Anytime you're doing a budget and you want to make reductions in a budget, you know, you need to start with the biggest uses. And there's a vast, you know, much has been done, as Mike said, in agriculture, but a lot more gains can be realized in the future. We
right.
need to keep working on it.
Let me get one more call in here because Victor is calling from Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Victor.
Hi. Yeah, out here in Austin, there's it's ground. The surface water is completely accounted for with the lake and the rivers. And my well has gone dry, and it seems like the city doesn't take any action to, you know, warn people that this is happening. They just keep giving incentives for businesses and developers to keep moving out here and drilling more wells, drilling deeper. And I don't know what to do because I can't go any deeper with my well because I'll hit that salty aquifer level down there.
Right. Victor, thank you so much for your call, that glimpse of current day realities in Austin, Texas. You know, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I wanted to sort of once again wrap our heads about what the consequences are if we do take action now versus if we don't. So briefly, Sandra Postel, 50 years from now, if, you know, a patchwork of regulation, conservation, and recharging of groundwater aquifers does not happen, you know, again, briefly, what does life look like in the West 50 years from now?
It'll look very different if we don't start taking action now. You know, we've seen this in the past where you have, you know, serious drought on top of stressed water supplies. You get really serious social and economic problems from that. We're seeing it around the world. We're going to see it in the West if we don't take charge of this issue. You'll see increasingly farmland being fallowed, and not voluntarily, but it will end up being an involuntary action because it'll be the only option there. We'll see, you know, people beginning to leave cities because either the water is so expensive or the taps aren't getting filled with water as routinely as they're accustomed to, or what have you. So, and the tourism economy, again, a $26 billion tourism economy in the West, depending on healthy river flows, that'll start to decline. So there'll be a social and economic decline in general as the water levels become less reliable and disappear. So really, every moment we delay now brings that possibility closer to hand.
Right.
So really, taking action now is really crucial.
Mike Wade, what does agriculture look like in 50 years if nothing's done? I mean, the Central Valley provides, what, 15% of the food that the Americans eat today?
Actually, the Central Valley provides about 30%, and California as a whole, 50% of the nation's fresh fruits and vegetables. We just have to ask ourselves if we want to rely on ourselves to feed Americans, or do we want to rely on offshore sources in the future? Where's the dependability? Where's the safety? Where are the social issues that affect the farm worker community, whether it's here or in other countries? And where are the protections for consumers that go to the grocery store to feed their families?
Mm. And Jay Famiglietti, last thought goes to you because you kicked off this conversation with those shocking findings about the reduction in groundwater in the Colorado River Basin. I mean, we've been hearing what life would be like in 50 years if we don't take significant action now. Do you think it's possible for sort of the panoply of solutions that are needed to actually be put into play?
I do. And I think it's because we have to. We really have no choice. If we don't, things will go in. You know, it will be a fairly apocalyptic scenario. So none of us want that. So I do think that it will be slow. It'll be difficult to change the policy. It won't be difficult to enact conservation efficiency. We've got tremendous technological advances waiting in the wings. Things can be done. It takes political will. It takes vision and leadership. And I'm confident that we can do it.
Well, Jay Famiglietti is professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and he co-authored this new study about water loss in the Colorado River Basin. Jay Famiglietti, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Mike Wade, executive director of the California Farm Water Coalition. Mike, great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Sandra Postel, an expert on global water issues and policy and director of the Global Water Policy Project, author of Last Oasis, Facing Water Scarcity. Sandra Postel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And coming up tomorrow on the show, Israel, Gaza, and the war crimes charge. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.